You are listening to Breaking Boundaries with Brad Palumbo.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the show. I'm really excited for this weekend's episode because I know I've talked to you guys before. I've been trying to get different types of guests and a more diverse range of guests on here than just conservatives and just libertarians. But it's not as easy as you'd think, actually, to get people to come on the podcast. So I have to say thank you and welcome to my next guest, Chris Hale. He was a Democratic candidate for Congress in Tennessee, and he is an alumni of the Obama White House. Chris, thanks for joining the show.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me, Brad.
So I know that you supported the Biden ticket and the Biden campaign. So I'd like to just kind of run with you, you know, not a hostile debate, but just kind of a Q&A, different concerns that conservatives and right of center people have with the Biden administration. So one thing to start with is I actually heard this during the campaign, even from center left people in my life who did vote for Biden, that they don't think he has dementia. There's no conspiracy theories, right? There are, but I don't believe those about him being like a puppet or anything. But he is old, right? He's very old. I think, is he 78? And anybody at that age does start to struggle, and it's such a demanding position. I mean, do you have any concerns about him going through such a stressful job for 4 years at such an advanced age?
Well, I imagine a lot of your listeners might be Roman Catholic like myself, and I remind them that when Pope Francis was elected, he was 78 years old. When Benedict XVI was elected, he was 79 years old. So there is age is a factor in any leadership of an institution like the United States government. But I'm confident that Joe Biden has the stamina to do the job. And one thing we got to realize, I think a lot of times we misunderstood the position, the presidency of the United States. It is an administrative function, administrative office, but it's also a moral office. It's an office of final decisions, of yes and no decisions. When a decision gets to President Trump's desk, when a decision gets to President Biden's desk, there's hundreds of hours from the top experts in the country, and they're determining a yes or no question. There's so much research and time and energy placed into it. So yes, it's a demanding job with unimaginable expectations. I think a good conservative would say too many expectations. We hold the presidency perhaps with too much power, with maybe even too much regard. But yes, it's not like we're asking the man to run a marathon every day. And there is mental fatigue that comes in with making decisions, but he's not doing it alone. And I think that what's happened, you know, use the papacy as a model once again, Pope Francis really humanized the papacy. He said, you know, I'm not a god. I'm not operating independent alone. I'm not superseding. I think there's going to be a humility towards the presidency of the United States. Some conservatives, I think, would say that's not a good thing, that perhaps they might grade that as some kind of like an apologist for that. But I think that the reality of it is we've got to reimagine the presidency of the United States. We have let it go to such a pathway that it's not a one-man show, but we act as if it is. So I am confident, because it's not just Joe Biden in there. It's an entire administration. We already have 1,000 political appointees for the administration. We'll have over 4,000 before the summer. So he's not doing it alone.
He's not. And that's why I think, just like with any president, who you pick as your vice president is a big bleeping deal, right? You're saying to the world, this is my guy or gal. This is who I want in the hot seat. If for some reason I have to retire, or I have a health issue, or God forbid you pass away. And I know that I'm praying, I didn't support Joe Biden, but I'm praying for his health. I'm rooting for good health for him. But I recently had two grandparents that are similarly to his age, both pass away in the last year. And he's got the best medical care in the world. We sure hope that he has great health. But it is absolutely a possibility that in the next 4 to 8 years, if he's reelected, he could at some point have to step down. That's true for any president. But particularly with people like Biden and Trump, when they're on the older side compared to someone like Obama, it's even more of a concern. So I want to talk about Kamala Harris for a moment, because I'm interested for your perspective, because from the conservative side of the aisle, we saw her as more of an extreme and more of a divisive pick than, for example, someone like an Amy Klobuchar. And this is interesting, right? Because this is not, I want to read you something and get your thoughts on it. This is from National Review. The left-wing group Progressive Punch analyzed Kamala Harris's voting record and found that she is the fourth most liberal senator, more liberal even than Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren. Similarly, the nonpartisan organization GovTrack.us deemed Harris the farthest left member of the Senate for the 2019 legislative year, even more so than Bernie Sanders. So do you think there's any truth to the idea that Kamala Harris, who's been elevated to such a position of prominence, is pretty extreme on the left-wing side?
Well, it's interesting. So I think that maybe your audience would have a contest with me about what the left wing of the Democratic Party is. I think you can go way to the left of Kamala Harris. I mean, her critics were not from the right. In my primary, in our Democratic Party, it was from the left. She was a prosecutor for the biggest state in the country. You could call her, in short, a law and order vice president. Comfortably smug, might call her a cop. she represents a law and order capacity. But also, too, I think it's fair to say that when you become a vice president of the United States, you operate in the context of the presidency. And if, God forbid, something happened to Joe Biden and Kamala Harris became president of the United States, she's likely to run for re-election and she's likely to run in a competitive primary. And we were told, you know, I've been dealing with the left wing of my party for my entire career. We were told that the moderate pathway to the Democratic Party was closed, that it was shut down, that it was not available. In fact, it was the strongest pathway forward. Joe Biden is president of the United States because conservative black Democrats from my part of the country, from South Carolina, from Tennessee, from Georgia, from the southern states, made him president of the United States, chose him over the liberal wing of the party. So I think the fact that Kamala Harris is a political animal should give comfort to folks on the right. Because realizes that the only pathway to winning this party's nomination going forward is to make appeals to the center. That's what Joe Biden did. He was unapologetically moderate throughout the entire campaign. It's really remarkable to some degree. Normally what happens is the nominee moves to the center because they need to solidify the votes of the party. Joe Biden spent the entire primary and 45 years of public life in the center, and he actually had to move a little bit to the left to appeal folks. I don't think though that Kamala Harris represents the extreme part of the left of the Democratic Party. Folks, I mean, like, she's not talking about revolution. She's not talking about systemic, like, wholesale structural change. She even backtracked on Medicare for All after about 10 minutes in 2019. She didn't last that long supporting Medicare for All because she realized that she's a political animal and she realized what the reality of the math was, is that it's got to be a middle pathway to running Democratic Party. So I do think the best way to describe it is I think Joe Biden, people say he's a moderate, he's a conservative Democrat. I think Joe Biden represents the middle of the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party has definitely gotten further to the left since he was the junior senator from Delaware in 1974. But he represents the middle of the party. And I think that's the most viable pathway forward. In some ways, you could say that was really Barack Obama too.
So let's talk about that, because I don't disagree with that characterization of the Biden campaign at all. I do think, though, what we've seen so far doesn't seem too moderate to me. I mean, I think with the definition of what is moderate in the Democratic Party has changed drastically since even 2015. So to give you a couple examples, in 2016, the Hillary campaign ran on about $1 trillion total new government spending over 10 years. Biden ran on about $4 trillion, and this is according to the Manhattan Institute. Kamala Harris ran on almost $40 trillion in new proposed spending. And I understand that she adopts the Biden's official positions, and those were her old campaign positions, but I still think it tells you something. It also, in 2016, Hillary Clinton opposed a federal $15 minimum wage nationwide. Biden now supports that and is pushing to do it in his COVID relief package. So isn't it fair to say that even if Biden is moderate for the Democrats, he's swung pretty substantially to the left on many economic policies?
I would say that's the truth of the Democratic Party writ large. And I think it's something that we see absolutely that it has happened. I think, too, though, what we see on that is when push comes to shove, even the $15 minimum wage plan, it doesn't go into effect until 2025. Now, my first job, I'm 31 years old. My first job at 16, 17 years old in Tennessee paid $7.25 an hour. So we haven't seen the minimum wage go up in my entire adult working life. So I do think that, yes, the party has moved to the left and Joe Biden is the leader of that party. But when push comes to shove and you have to get the votes in the United States Senate, in the United States Congress, the most powerful player in all of American politics today, and this should give you hope for those on the right, is Joe Manchin. Joe Manchin is the heart and center of whether or not legislation gets passed in this Congress, in this presidency. And I can speak, I know this directly, that Joe Manchin and the President of the United States have talked on the phone 3 times in the first week of his administration. So I think you should feel confident that Bernie Sanders definitely plays a role in this party. Elizabeth Warren definitely plays a role in this party. But Joe Manchin is the linchpin of this party. And folks that just got elected, Mark Kelly, for example, Raphael Warnock, for example, they're up for election in 2022. So we understand the realities of having to deliver on the priorities that matter to the American people. But we also know, I think we know how to do it in a way that's not going to get us slaughtered at the ballot box. Do you know what scares me and scares most progressives is the thought of Cocaine Mitch coming back to power, coming back from the dead, and being reelected, if you will, the majority leader of the United States Senate. So we know the fragility of the House, and we know the fragility of the Senate. Really, the House is in deep trouble just because of gerrymandering alone. And so I think the Democrats are going to be thoughtful on what they push through. And look, my party's good at virtue signaling, okay? Just because we put a bill up there on the floor on day one, what's Joe Biden going to put his fight behind? What's he going to put his energy on? What's he going to put his political capital on? I think it's going to be the bread and butter issues that have been the mainstream of the Democratic Party for 50 years, which is economic issues and healthcare.
But so I was honestly stunned to see him come out and put that $15 minimum wage in the COVID relief package. And I know it would phase in till 2025, but that's still a big jump. So the nonpartisan CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, says that that would eliminate 1.3 to 3.7 million jobs. That's an estimate from before COVID. Now you've got small businesses all over the country that are on the brink of collapse. And all of a sudden they're going to have their wage bill hiked. Do you think so? I mean, first addressing the policy of it, how is that a good idea, especially right now? And two, do you think there's going to be some buyer's remorse from small businesses or moderate voters who voted for Joe and then see that kind of policy right from the get-go?
Well, they won't see it. I mean, so the administration has is not put its energy behind any single bill, but the bill right now proposed by leadership in the House and the Senate, the Democratic Party, is $15 in 2025. If you go on left Twitter, there's outrage because they feel like they've been sold down the drain because the Biden plan is not pushing for $15 minimum wage now. I think the reality of it is my understanding of Joe Biden, I've known the man for over a decade, is I think that he is putting out feelers to see what can work and what cannot. He also has to appease a lot of parts of the base that got him elected, and that's just the reality of politics. But I don't think you should be concerned that $15 minimum wage is coming down on July 1. I do think it's a pathway which we're going about. And we've got to acknowledge that the Bernie Sanders effect in this party for the past 5-6 years is profound. This, in a lot of ways, is a response to Bernie Sanders' economic populism. But look, you know, I ran for Congress in one of the most rural and reddest areas of the country. $15 minimum wage is a non-starter in places where that is a beyond middle class living. What we need, and I think what we'll see is eventually, is index rated minimum wages. $15 is very different in New York City than it is in Grundy County, Tennessee. And we need to understand the realities of that. And I hope what I see from President Biden and the Democratic leadership in the House and the Senate is an understanding of different ways of life. My party is getting their ass kicked in rural America. If you look at the reality of it, there is not much political difference in rural Minnesota and rural Wisconsin and rural Alabama. We have lost rural voters. It is bleeding beyond belief. You know, I got my ass kicked in rural Tennessee. Joe Biden got his ass kicked in rural Tennessee. And the reason why is I think we've lost touch with the values of rural Tennessee and rural communities and understood what matters to them. It is economic populism, but it's economic populism girded in reality. I love AOC. She represents the Bronx. You know, and the realities of the Bronx are not the realities of the hills of Tennessee. And we need a Democratic Party that represents both.
Well, it is interesting how Biden is perceived, because from where like the true left sits, they're constantly thinking he's some, you know, corporatist capitalist sellout hack. But then from the right side of the aisle, they're constantly thinking he's big government liberal with a sweeping agenda. I kind of think that both things can be true at once, in the sense that the two visions that the right and the true left have for America are so far apart in terms of the economy that if Joe Biden is somewhere in the middle, that still puts him on the solidly on the center left on the economics. But those people are just so far to the left that they think he's some, you know, right wing capitalist. But I want to ask about taxes, because one of the things that Biden said was no new taxes on anybody that's going to earn less than $400,000. I always thought that that was a great talking point, but kind of misleading for a couple reasons. One, it's true he didn't propose direct income taxes on middle class families, but he did want to bring back the Obamacare individual mandate, which was a tax, and it hit a lot of middle class families and working class families. And two, he wants to raise taxes such as corporate taxes, where there's a lot of economic research that shows those are in part borne by workers. So the tax isn't formally on workers, but part of it is taken out of their paycheck or passed on to consumers and higher costs. So the third thing, too, is that if you're increasing government debt over time, that does mean higher taxes, even if it's just to pay more taxes to service the debt. So can people really believe Biden's promises that taxes aren't going to go up for the middle class over the next 4 years?
I think so. I mean, we can have fights about modern monetary theory and deficit spending. Obviously, both parties love deficit spending.
Unfortunately, from my view.
Yeah, Brad Palumbo doesn't make him happy. And that's just a reality that, you know, I find it intriguing that it's always the opposition party that is concerned about deficit spending, but when they're in power, they're going to push through their agenda, and no matter how much it costs. I'm going back to the question of raising taxes. I do think that what we're going to see is we're going to see an emphasis from Joe Biden on middle-class families. One of the biggest weaknesses of Obamacare and one of the biggest weaknesses of the Democratic Party writ large over the past 30 years is we're kind of obsessed with that first quartile of economic households from 0 to 25. And we want to increase the welfare state to ensure that people who are living on the verges of poverty are taken care of. But we know, and you know, that folks in the median income brackets from the 40% to 60%, what happens is a lot of our government programs that are intended to help those at the very bottom hurt the next class, hurt the 40% to 60%, hurt the middle class folks, or hurt the working folks. I think that what Joe Biden's got to do, yes, we are a party that cares about the poor, the sick, the marginalized, but we also care about those folks who are working their asses off to make a living. And the best example I have is here in Tennessee. It's absurd. In Tennessee, you can work 40 hours a week at a minimum wage job and not be eligible for health care in Tennessee. So if you work, but if you do not, if you just stay at home, you don't work, you're eligible for health care.
That makes not much sense.
It doesn't make much sense. And it causes backlash. Understandable. If you're working at Subway in rural Tennessee and you're doing your best and you're putting your 40 hours a week, but you're not eligible for Medicaid, and then someone who's not putting the work in, not putting the effort in, but they can sign up and get their checks, it's not fair. So I think that Joe Biden's got to be really concerned about the folks who are not receiving benefits from this government and putting the work in, ensuring that we're doing whatever it takes to make their lives better. And I think it's his history. You know, I went to breakfast with Joe Biden several times in 2014, 15, and 16 at his old residence, the naval residence in Washington, D.C. And what really struck me is Joe, in disposition and in temperament and philosophy, is establishment. There's no doubt about it. But he has a particular sway over middle-class voters, blue-collar voters, that are very adjacent to the Bernie Sanders crowd and Donald Trump crowd. What separates a Bernie Sanders, Joe Biden, Donald Trump voters? Not a lot in a lot of the places that I live in this country. I think people have hope that he will be a champion of the working class. I think that what we've had is with President Trump, I think it was all talk, but he never actually delivered, in my opinion, for the working people of this country. Joe Biden's got to. But here's what's really important. He can't be guided by the forces of Wall Street. He can't be guided by the radical folks, the woke left. He's got to be guided by middle class economics. Now, what that's going to be is he's going to perhaps, if you will, renege on some of those progressive agenda items to figure out what matters the most. The best way I put it is we are in an incredible crisis in this country. I think Joe Biden knows that. We can't be working on cholesterol issues. And so do I think the repeal of Trump tax cuts are coming first? I do not. I don't think that's going to be the reality. I do think he's going to be focused on low-wage workers.
So you brought up healthcare, which is interesting. Oh, and fun fact, my first job was at a Subway in high school.
Where did you grow up?
So I grew up in the suburbs of Massachusetts, okay, about an hour outside Boston.
And I worked, Sox fan.
I don't like baseball, to okay. be honest. Sorry. But Patriots was really the huge thing, not even the Sox. The Sox are big in Boston, but the rest of the state, they're like, okay, with the older people, everybody loves the Patriots.
Sure,
and
sure.
Until recently, Tom Brady. I mean, was like, he was the closest thing that a lot of people in Massachusetts have to a god, not an overly religious state. I mean, there's...
Well, it's interesting. For the rest of this country, I think the 49 other states, Tom Brady's actually proved that Satan exists. That keeps on winning. It's frustrating to the rest of us.
Yeah, it's been funny, actually, watching him leave and have people... Some people have switched on a dime about how they felt about him. But anyway, to go back, I don't think I ever would have gotten hired at that Subway if the starting was $15 an hour. But sure. We won't beat that to death. You mentioned healthcare, and I want to talk about healthcare because one of the things that got Joe Biden elected, got him the nomination, and got him in the White House instead of Donald Trump was that he did not run on Medicare for all. Mm-hmm. He ran on a Medicare public option, which for folks who don't know, means the government creates a program and opens it up that people can enroll in, but they don't eliminate all private insurance like Medicare for all would. And a lot of voters didn't want their private insurance to go away like it would under Medicare for all. But here's the thing. If Biden actually put into place a public option, a lot of conservative healthcare policy analysts say that over 10, 15, 20 years, that would crowd out basically all private insurance in the sense that the government can subsidize its own rates in a way that obviously a private competitor can't. And it can also force doctors and hospitals to accept a lower 60% reimbursement rate that they don't have to accept from private companies. So the fear is that private companies can't really compete with the government in healthcare because it's not fair. So that anyway, 15, 20 years from now, we end up with Medicare for all anyway. So what do you make of those concerns? Because it was so important to his campaign, but was it really just kind of a delaying of the inevitable?
Yes. I mean, that's the honest to God truth. I mean, the plan, the behind the vista, it's not a secret, is that Democrats, we believe that a pathway to single payer is the best pathway. And absolutely, when you extend this out, you know, the conservative critique of history is correct in this way. The conservative critique is that when you add government programs, people like them and you cannot repeal them. You know, and Mitt Romney learned that the hard way. That's what he ran on. In 2012, it did not work. So yes, I think it is the game plan. Now you talk about the government being an unfair player because of the ability to subsidize. What we'd argue on the left is saying that what we're doing is giving a better deal to the American people. Now, it's going to be complicated. We have to acknowledge, I think the left has to really acknowledge, that we're making fundamental choices when we go down the pathway of single payer. We are choosing winners and losers, which, you know, that's part of the function that we're arguing here that we need to do, that we need to better reset the deck. But we've got to figure out a way. We've got to figure out a way to get there successfully, because right now the pathway is bloody. It's dirty. The pathway to single payer is never pretty. That was always the biggest holdup of Bernie. You know, he released a single payer plan. He ran on Medicare for all of 2016, but people don't understand. He actually had no plan. He developed the plan in 2017, but it was very vague on those details on how we get there. And that is just the stumbling block of this. It's always been the case. You know, in 1993, Hillary Care was essentially single payer, got rolled back and back and back. The Democratic Party has found no pathway to single payer except through attrition over time. And so I do think public option is probably going to be the last domino, though. Honestly, the last domino towards a single payer, because those competition with government funding, government support, it's going to be hard to pass up. So, you know, I don't think Blue Cross Blue Shield is the question you got to have on the right is, how powerful is Blue Cross Blue Shield? How powerful is Aetna? How powerful is Cigna in this White House? But this being said, if you look at these first few days of the Biden administration, we have the executive orders on a slew of issues. We haven't had a lot on healthcare just yet. What's happened is, I think in some ways, COVID-19 has given us a nice excuse to punt on these bigger questions. We have an immediate healthcare crisis right now that's dividing the party, that's dividing, or immediate healthcare crisis right now that distracts from the bigger questions dividing the party. But what's interesting about it, and I think that Biden's going to have to contend with in his base, Medicare for All is very popular in the Democratic Party, and it's pretty popular, particularly with voters under 50. Biden will likely be the last president of the United States from the Democratic Party, last presidential nominee for Democratic Party, who does not run on single-payer health care. Those days are over in this party. Sorry to come with the bad news for y'all.
Yeah, that's not great for us from where we sit. But, well, let me ask you about that, because one of the trade-offs is, first, let me say that our current healthcare system is beyond messed up. It is not a free market. It's not. I don't support the status quo.
Sure.
However, one thing is that we fail in a lot of ways compared to other countries in healthcare, but we do have some of the most innovation, some of the most new drug production, some of the most innovative cancer treatments, and really successful rates of innovation. I don't have the stats in front of me, but we rank really highly on that. And lots of economists would say that's because we still do have a private profit element to our healthcare system. Are you concerned that part of that trade-off means that goes away?
Yeah, I mean, look what we just had happen over the past year. I mean, it wasn't, you know, the federal government subsidized it, paid the research, but it was private companies in the context of competition that got us the vaccine. I heard from a lot of Bernie folks, Bernie staffers, et cetera, that they made the claim that they were skeptical that the private healthcare companies could do it in record time. It seems they did it in time that the federal government of the United States would never be able to achieve. Democrats have got to acknowledge that the marketplace can be a force for good. We cannot let socialists take over the party. We've got to acknowledge that capitalism has created the best economy in human history. It has reduced poverty in this country over time. Yes, it should not be the center place of life. The human person should be the center place of the economy, but capitalism can be a tool for good. And so what we've got to do, I think, is we've got to acknowledge that there are going to be shortcomings. We cannot pretend that the Canadian healthcare system is a panacea of human life, or the French healthcare system is the greatest thing that happened. NIH has problems every day. We're going to have to own that there are weaknesses with single-payer healthcare, and if our party does not acknowledge them, look what happened with the Tories in United Kingdom. They've been in functional power for 15 years now over this very issue. It caused us lost majorities in the House for a time, in the Senate. So healthcare has been the thorn in the side of the progressive movement globally for a long time. I do think more government is the inevitable pathway, but we got to do it in a way that helps, in a way, the way that delivers towards the ends. What's problematic is we can live in utopia. We have these dreams about what single payer can do, but we got to look at the reality on the ground. We're choosing winners and losers, and maybe that's the right choice to make. I think it's important that we ensure those on the margins have access to healthcare that can be treated, but we need to acknowledge the shortcomings of it. And I hope, and I think that President Biden will do that. I think that's why he's not for Medicare for All. I think he sees the reality. He saw it implemented in countries across Europe and in North America, and he saw what happened. I think he's actually being politically thoughtful on this, because we will own this. We own Obamacare. I think it's so far it has a slim majority support in this country, and we will own the public option. We will own the iterations. I would love to see the Republican Party, I would love to see adopt a Brad Palumbo plan or some plan on healthcare. You know, we've been hearing repeal, but there's been no replace. And the repeal is now completely out of the question. It's not happening. So I want the Republican solution to healthcare, and we haven't seen it.
That's a valid critique, I will say. They never had a good plan. I think there are free market models. You look at Switzerland, or you look at the Singapore model, where they have universal emergency care, but then a totally private free market. There's tons of ideas, but
we call that like mini Medicare for all, mini universal, like catastrophic universal.
Right. I mean, even that would require less government spending than we currently spend now. So I agree with you. There are lots of conservatives who have no plan, and the GOP has failed on that front. But I want to touch on something you said a minute ago, was the way that you just talked about capitalism, right? And that's not how I look at capitalism, but that is, I think, a pretty sane view of capitalism. That's where how a lot of people feel about it, what you just articulated. That's the Obama view of capitalism. That's the Hillary Clinton view of capitalism. That is the Joe Biden view of capitalism. But I would argue that that's not the future of the party based on all things right now. Who are the up and coming young Democrats? Who do young Democratic voters support or stan, right? It's AOC, it's Bernie Sanders. And these are people who reject capitalism, at least vocally, and they embrace the socialist label. So how, for middle of the road voters looking at the Democratic Party, how can they conclude anything other than the future of the Democratic Party is openly socialist?
I mean, so I think that you have to look at the reality that the Democratic Party is headed by the President of the United States. And, you know, Joe Biden, I'm going to use Catholic lingo again, for the Catholic Church, the Pope is the church. The Pope sets the authority, sets the agenda, sets the dogma. In electoral politics, Joe Biden is a Democratic Party. He has set the Democratic Party. He is the titular head of the Democratic Party. You know, I love Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. I got 125,000 votes and lost with 30 points, okay? And she got 138,000 votes and won her election. So she's got 13,000 more votes than me. So is she the titular head of the Democratic Party? Is she truly the head of the party? Does she actually have the votes to prove it? She won a low primary turnout against Joe Crowley, and he didn't.
But she has huge social media and cultural influence.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's interesting. You're right, and that's true. I mean, look, you know, you and I are we're part of the blue check community on social media. If the blue checks controlled the Democratic Party, Joe Biden would not have been the nominee. I mean, he won in spite of we call it CW, the conventional wisdom, the Twitter conventional wisdom was he was not going to be the nominee. And black voters told Twitter to go F themselves. Black voters, I mean, it was remarkable. You heard, I'm going to rant for a minute. You heard the woke left say that, you know, Joe was the establishment choice of the Democratic Party and the establishment was dead. I'm sorry, I just don't think black grandmothers in South Carolina are like the establishment, corporate establishment of the Democratic Party. And so I think what we're seeing here is that the worlds we live in, and journalists, you know, who oftentimes frame the narrative, it's so remarkable. I'll talk to journalists here in Tennessee who their entire worldview is formed by social media. In rural Tennessee, I can assure you that Twitter does not stand like ground. Now, Facebook sure as hell does. Facebook groups sure do. But I think we've let Twitter really kind of define our view and let the media define their view of the Democratic Party, of the progressive movement. But I think the black grandmother in South Carolina is actually really the core part of this movement. And so, yes, you know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is an important part of this party. But so is John Ossoff, so is Raphael Warnock, so is Jamie Harrison, and so is Joe Cunningham. And so there are competing factions in the Democratic Party. You know, Claire McCaskill once said that she likes Democrats who can beat Republicans. And I would just remind, you know, Bernie Sanders is a great man. Vermont is as blue as can be. I would like Bernie to come in Tennessee and run in Tennessee. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, if she can get elected statewide in Tennessee, she will become my queen. Like, I just think that we've got to have Democrats who can beat Republicans, and that's the harder march. And Joe Biden beat a Republican. He beat a Republican incumbent. And, you know, it's my perspective that only Joe Biden could have done that.
So that's an interesting one. And I want to shift on something because you're absolutely right. The woke left had Joe Biden last, only second to, I think, Tulsi was lower on how much who they liked on the woke left.
And it's funny, Tulsi was the woke champion, like, you know, 4 years ago. So, like, she was Bernie Sanders' co-chair.
She was, but she pissed them off by doing
the Assad stuff, and then
she's very. So I like her a lot, but she's very iconoclastic. So on random things, she breaks with the wisdom.
She didn't kiss the ring at all.
She refused to kiss. That's a great way to put it. It's like when she endorsed Bernie over Hillary in 2016, that got her off the nice list with the DNC. Anyway, though, so she Biden did run as a moderate, and that's not who the woke Twitter left wanted at all. But in some ways, though, and this is about the question of identity politics more broadly, I don't we could talk all day and do another podcast about how Republicans mishandle issues of race and identity in many ways. So don't think I'm defending that. But looking at the left, the total toxic identity politics of the far left are not Joe Biden's politics, but he does seem to have internalized and embraced some of it to some extent. Like, for example, when he promised to only pick an African-American woman for Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. Now, I think there are many African-American women who may be qualified. I would have no problem at all if one of them was selected. But that seems like tokenist identity politics to me, to say only African-American women, nobody else. And that is the position he took. So is it fair to look at the Biden-Harris administration or campaign and say that they've internalized a fair bit of that identity politics?
I don't like the word internalize. It goes into a realm that I'm not comfortable psychologizing the president, but I'll say this. I think that it's a political calculation. I mean, I think that's just a reality. It's a political calculation that we can be uncomfortable with. Both sides play it. You know, I think Donald Trump did the identity card with white evangelicals here in the South. You know, the man has never read the Bible. You know, he's not particularly religious, but he spoke code. He openly spoke about courting white evangelicals. And I think that's why, you know, Mike Pence, good man, was vice president of the United States. So, yes, I think that is the case. I think that what we're going to have to try to really do, and this is actually something that I kind of miss about Bernie Sanders 2016. Bernie Sanders 2016 was just pure economic populism. And then
he didn't do the woke stuff.
Oh, no, he didn't. But he I think what happened is he bent over backwards to do it, and it cost him. It really cost him because it's not the identity of most Democrats in this country. Let me just put it this way. A couple years ago, I think it's a good way to understand how I see it. Now, folks might not know this. So I split my time between D.C. and rural Tennessee. Very different worlds. Suburb of rural Tennessee. You know, this place used to be as blue as could be, you know, but it is ruby red beyond belief. The day I was born, you were born in Massachusetts. The day I was born, Tennessee was bluer than Massachusetts. Now, Democrats in Tennessee were not Michael Dukakis Democrats anyway, but the Democratic Party had historic roots here, you know, and some of them quite dark, quite frankly. But we lost this part of the country all throughout my adult life. We're now one of the reddest states in the country. But here, I think, is an example of something that happened. A couple of years ago, I was in a coffee shop in my community right around Christmas Day. And it was in the Christmas season, right around Christmas Eve. And these women were having a Bible study. And they pick up the newspaper, and it was about the North Carolina bathroom bills. And one woman said to the other woman, you know, I would care about that issue. I don't know what a transgender person is. I don't know what that word means. I don't understand what that word means. And then another woman said to her, you know, I would spend more time understanding it and researching it if I didn't spend all my time, all my energy worrying about making a living for me and my family. And to me, that struck me to the core. Identity politics oftentimes is at the leisure of those who have the time to do it, who can understand it. You know, I don't know if my parents or grandparents are particularly well-versed on queer theory, but it doesn't make them bad people. It doesn't make them we shouldn't cancel them. They just don't understand it. They don't understand it. And what we got to realize, I think, on the left.
Don't cancel Chris's parents.
Please don't. The vast majority of people in this country are worried about simple things close to their lives, making a living for them and their families. And we've got to put that at the center of our lives. Yes, we care about racial justice. Yes, we care about immigrants. Yes, we care about the LGBT community. But we got to realize that most people in this country have one focus from waking up to going to making a living for themselves and their families. And I do not care what coalition got Joe Biden to the White House. I know Joe. We know Joe. And I'm confident he understands that it's not the academics who are running Joe Biden's White House. I do believe that we will know that Joe Biden is running this administration. He's not a tool for this or that. If there is a focus this first year in office on folks who are just trying to make a living for themselves and their families, they can be gay or straight, black, white, Latino, it does not matter. If he's focused on that, we will win. And also too, I think, frankly, if the Republican Party goes back to that mindset, I think what was so problematic with Trump's era is they swung at every pitch. Everything became a new issue every day. And we kind of lost that sense of that economic populism. The best line that Trump had there in the election was, Joe Biden wants to restore the nation. I want to give you a job. And so we got to, both parties, I think, are going to have this fight about just being job-centered policymakers, job-centered politicians. When I go out on the campaign trail, the number one issue that I've heard time and again is get us better jobs. People want to work. They want good jobs. They want economic opportunity. And they're not particularly obsessed with the latest outrage issues that come up. I don't think Benny Johnson should be the future of the Republican Party. I'm sorry. I don't think Benny Johnson should be. I think that the future of both our parties have got to be folks that are really in touch with just everyday people and everyday issues.
All right, Chris, I think that's a good place to leave the serious talk for this time. But I will say I really do appreciate you coming on and having this sure. conversation. I wish more people would. It's hard to get people across the aisle or from opposite sides of the spectrum to sit down and have a conversation. But I really do appreciate it. And I appreciate to the listeners who are Republican, who voted for Trump or MAGA, or maybe are just right wing, who got through this episode and heard Chris out, because it is important to not live in a partisan bubble. So, sure. Chris, we can set all the partisanship aside sure. and you can hit us with your hot food take.
Okay, so Nashville hot chicken is I'm from Nashville originally. That's a Nashville hot chicken is a it's actually not originally from Nashville in most sense, but it is a hitting the nation. And I think that your viewers, if they're able, where they're living, I think on Friday night, the best Nashville hot chicken is at Chili's. They should go to Chili's. They should have a margarita. Comfortably Smug, I feel like, would do this. They should have a margarita, and they should have Nashville hot chicken, and tell them that I sent you there. I am the biggest stan of middle-class Chili's dining. I will probably go there tonight. So
Nashville, I love Chili's. So I'm going to take – I've never had their Nashville hot chicken, but I'm going to try that. That sounds delicious. Chris, thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Brad.
Everybody, that's it for this week. Thanks for tuning in. We'll talk to you again on Wednesday.
You are listening to Breaking Boundaries with Brad Palumbo.